We'd like to examine the backdrop, really, of what's likely to make headlines this weekend. It's become the most dangerous flashpoint in our region, North Korea, which marks its Independence Day today. We'll surely see the usual images of military parades and performances from Pyongyang later today, but the whole world's on tenterhooks. Will the nation also mark its foundation with another missile or nuclear weapons test? What we'd like to do this morning is delve a bit deeper into the histories of the various countries drawn into this drama, directly and indirectly. We probably feel more comfortable with the complex rivalries within the various European cultures, or even now the Middle East. What do we really know of those same tensions in the broader Asian region over centuries, not merely the last peaceful, economically successful decade? Is this essential regional peace over the last generation typical or an anomaly? It's an important distinction. So to help us understand better, I'm joined now by Michael Wesley, who's Professor of International Affairs and Dean of the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University, and who's specifically covered lesser-known histories of the region in his prize-winning 2011 book, There Goes the Neighbourhood. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Michael.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Just to North Korea first, before we go a little deeper, there seems to be no sign of them stepping back from their tests and so-called gift packages for the United States. How concerned are you that we'll see another launch or test soon?
Look, I'm very concerned that we will. We've fallen into this habit of seeing North Korea and Kim Jong-un as some sort of a mad state that does things for no rational reason. But when you actually look at why they're doing this and why Kim Jong-un is doing this, he's really creating a sense that that North Korea is at the centre of world politics, and that the world is an unremittingly hostile and dangerous place for North Korea. So what he's actually doing is setting up this narrative of self-affirmation and importance for North Korea. The really dangerous thing for the West, and actually all of the countries of the region, is that it is, he now has nuclear weapons. He has increasingly capable missile capabilities, and the possibility that he can marry the two together. What we're moving towards is a situation of deterrence with North Korea. And the problem for our strategic policymakers is that this guy doesn't seem to have anything that he holds so dear that would force him not to use these things. So that's a really, really dangerous situation.
It does seem like a gambling mentality. So that really prompts the question that has been powering us this week. Are there elements of this whole North Korean behaviour that, as a student of the region and its history, as you are not sufficiently understood? That if we understood better, we might have, our policy settings might even be cleverer.
Look, I think that one of the things that we forget at our peril is how immediate history is in Northeast Asia, and in fact, in most of the Asian continent. We in the West tend to have this very teleological view of history, that history is something that just extends back into the past, and the further away it gets, the less relevant it is to us. Most Asian countries have, or societies have, a more cyclical view of history. They tend to interpret current events according to their understandings of what's happened historically. And so, we
reinvent ourselves, as it were.
Yeah, we tend to see history as an ever-improving kind of straight line, whereas they see history as always coming back. And in not really understanding history as the histories of our region as a society, Australia is really handicapping itself in actually understanding and being able to operate effectively in this part of the world.
Well, certainly, I think a lot of Australians have been tourists to the region, and you do find out there, as I certainly did when I visited Angkor Wat, that you have these sort of waves of circling, competencies. So that one century you might have the Thais in charge, another century it'll be the Vietnamese, another one it'll be the Khmers. It moves. It sort of it rotates, as it were. And China sitting there, you know, watching it all carefully, to say the least. I don't. Even if we grasp that, I wonder what we do with it.
Yeah, look, that's right. I mean, these are intensely hierarchic societies, whether they're communist or liberal democracy or something in between. They all have deeply hierarchic structures in their language, in their social relations, and they also are deeply hierarchic in the way that they see themselves and their surrounding societies. And so their sense of self is very much bound up with their understanding of history, of periods when they were dominant and periods when they were dominated. And that's very much a part of the current way that a lot of these societies look at the outside world and particularly look at the way that they're engaging with their neighbours.
All, the French and the Germans have this too, and so far have found means, whether it's the European Union or whatever, it's not just forgiving and forgetting, it's setting up systems that actually quell some of those emotions. Now, is that available here in the Asian region?
It's not immediately apparent that it's happening anywhere, Geraldine, this, particularly in Northeast Asia. A couple of my colleagues, Amy King and Brendan Taylor, call it the negative history spiral in Northeast Asia, where each of the three countries, Korea, China, Japan, look at each other and look at each other's behaviour in terms of these broader moral narratives about what they've done wrong in history. And each accusation is countered with a counter-accusation that is deeply rooted in history. That's very much a sense of what North Korea is doing. It also animates relations in South Korea as well. So just over a decade ago, back in 2004-2005, you may remember the dispute over Chinese versus Korean claims around the Kingdom of Koguryo, which was a sort of turn of the, around 37 BC to 600 AD. There were people marching in the streets about this, and there was a sense in South Korea that by claiming this history, China was actually denying the historic greatness of the Korean people. You just can't imagine
Lin Yan, you end up dealing in stereotypes then, don't you?
Stereotypes are a very big part of it. And there is a sense in which people do carry around stereotypes in their heads. And I think a lot of these stereotypes are also reinforced by a lot of the education systems. And so, of course, there are really big and serious controversies over how countries in Northeast Asia are writing their school textbooks in history.
Right now.
Absolutely, right now. And often these are raised as accusations that they are denying history or that they are making false claims about history.
So finding a common ground that is not based on economics, because my obviously underneath this great, a generation or two of peace in this region, Alan DuPont was writing about this last week, is this extraordinary economic growth, as they quotes, caught up with the West. Now, by the sound of you, that isn't sufficiently cohesive to enable a new sort of rhetoric or grand narrative to emerge. Is it that because they've now have, like, you know, South Korea and China in particular have just made, and Japan made the most extraordinary strides, but it doesn't quell these underlying emotions?
Look, I think unfortunately the evidence points in exactly the opposite direction. I think as many of the societies of our region become wealthier and more powerful, they are starting to prosecute these rivalries in a much more intense fashion. And I think we'll actually look back over the decade that's just gone, probably beginning in 2008, and look at it as a time when really history awoke in Asia, and countries stopped their single-minded pursuit of prosperity and started to prosecute much more identity-based issues, and of course with much greater means. They're becoming much, much better armed as they become wealthier and wealthier.
Well, that is, of course, the huge risk, isn't it, of the North Korean situation, that it prompts a nuclear race in the region. And I notice Hugh White, the analyst, arguing that there's growing resentment. This is just one unlikely side effect against Kim Il-sung inside China, Kim Jong-un, pardon me, both in the general public and the policy establishment, because China believes that North Korea, it helps North Korea, but to many Chinese, the young leader seems ungrateful. And Japan watching clearly must be thinking about arming themselves differently.
Look, that's right. This could have really big consequences. The first one is that Japan suddenly decides that the American nuclear umbrella is not sufficient to defend it against North Korean aggression. Japan has long been regarded as the state that could go nuclear the fastest in the world. It has a lot of fissile material from its nuclear power stations, and it has the technology to be able to convert it. There are people who think that Japan could develop a nuclear weapon within 6 months. There are signs that the South Koreans have also been interested in developing their own nuclear deterrent, and that the Taiwanese might also do so. This would actually reduce the need for their alliances with the United States. If they had an independent nuclear deterrent, they would no longer need that alliance so much, and it would profoundly change the American role in the region. So all of these events for us are real possibilities, and they would have enormous consequences for Australia.
Look, it's a difficult question to ask you next, but I noticed that you were writing in a recent book, actually acknowledging Professor Robert O'Neill's contribution to Australian foreign policy thinking, and you talked about Asia pessimists and Asiaphoria, the Asia pessimism and Asiaphoria, sort of dividing almost the people who look at this, different attitudes altogether. I just wonder what a place like this is so much in our interest to try to think whether we can be helpful and useful, this young European country with a great past, of course. What can we do? Anything?
Look, I think we do have a history of really creative diplomacy. There are some times in the past in the region. I think of helping end the war in Cambodia. I think of the creation of APEC. These are instances where Australians really did take real risks and come up with really innovative ideas and then acted behind it. I certainly think there is a role for Australia to play as a real change agent in the region in trying to bring some of these countries together. In some ways, it's good that we don't share the kind of sense of being bound by history.
Fatalism, almost.
The fatalism that a lot of these societies have. But at the same time, we do need to get more serious about understanding the region. I'm continue to be just appalled at how little Asian history we teach our kids at school. We are still very much trapped in teaching our children European history and Western history. That is going to be less and less helpful in the world that we're going into. We need to understand these countries as they understand themselves.
And Michael Wesley is my guest, and he's very much a scholar of Asia. I noticed a recent book called Makers of Modern Asia, Ramachandra Guha, sort of said that Asia was obsessed with the West throughout the 19th and 20th centuries in a way that the West is now obsessed with Asia. I wonder if you think that is right, and how we encourage Australians to believe it's worth engaging.
Look, I don't actually agree with that. I don't see very much sign that we are as we in the West are as obsessed by Asia as it continues to be by the West. There is just not the evidence that we are learning Asian languages, that we are studying Asian history, that we are watching Asian culture and reading Asian books. We struggle to continue to teach our young people about the region, that the interest really is very weak. And I certainly hope he's right about that this is how we get into the future, but I can't really see that evidence now.
So in terms of then what comes next, who might be the broker of change? Is it China then, which has traditionally played this extraordinary role where it believes it's the superior culture? Now, there's quite a lot of arguments that one of the reasons why President Xi doesn't get more involved in pulling North Korea up, because it's not even in North Korea's interest, as Jeff Raby, China's interest, as Jeff Raby pointed out to us on Saturday Extra a couple of weeks back, to have sort of new missile systems installed in South Korea, for instance. It's starting to really affect them. But that he wants to keep the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, on side, and is vital for his own internal cohesion, and that he's got to be very careful himself. He's hemmed in as to what he can do with North Korea. Now, I wonder what your judgment is there.
Look, I don't think China will be the broker of any particular new order. I think a lot of what's happening in the region is prompted by a worry about China, a belief that China, as it gets more powerful, as it gets wealthier, as other countries become more economically dependent on it, will try and construct what it sees as a historical pattern, and that is that it is the paramount power in the region to which all others defer. I think as that reality starts to be more and more imaginable, countries such as Japan, the two Koreas, I would say, as well as some in South Asia and Southeast Asia, become more and more uncomfortable with that prospect. And so I think a lot of the strategic churn that we're seeing in the region has that kind of dread of an all-powerful China behind it. So I think the best thing that we can hope for is that what we're seeing is a transition away from a unipolar system in which the United States was really the holder of the ring in the region, towards a much more fluid and in some ways unbalanced multipolar system in which there's not only the United States and China as powerful countries, but perhaps also Japan, perhaps India, perhaps Indonesia, perhaps Vietnam, sort of maintaining a sort of fluid and hopefully stable balance between them. And also giving a voice to smaller countries like Australia.
Well, yes, a watch and wait. Thank you very much indeed for those insights, Michael Worsley. I really appreciate them.
That's my great pleasure, Geraldine.
Michael Worsley, Professor of International Affairs and Dean of the College of Asia and the Pacific at ANU.